Is that close enough? Okay.
Hi, I'm Renee Marshall. I'm here at Stories from the OC, Irvine, California Story Corps. It's the last day of 2019. It's December 31st, 2019, and I'm here with Ms. Vivica.
My name is Ms. Vivica, and I'm here with Renee to discuss my latest book, which is Valor to Victory, Removing the Drama from Your Trauma.
I am so glad we're here in the sound booth. How do we know each other, Ms. Vivica?
Well, I'm actually a minister at one of the local churches, and Renee recently visited the church and became a member, and we just kind of gravitated towards one another. I think I reached out to you by phone, and you shared some of your experiences with me, which were incredible, and we just launched into a conversation and shared some of the things, and you invited me here, and I'm just so glad that you did.
Yes, we're both active at the Second Baptist Church of Santa Ana. And I'm so glad to be here with you. And your story is such an important one. Would you begin by telling your story of 3 a.m.?
In the story, in the book Valor to Victory, there are several stories, and it was prompted behind my, as a result of my own experience, and which is titled 3 a.m. 3 a.m. started pretty much the day before. Earlier in the day, I had gone out to dinner with a colleague of mine and went to bed like any other night. And it was at 3 a.m. the following morning on January 23rd of 2014 that I heard a loud crashing sound. And when I heard the sound, it startled me so much that I jumped up out of the bed and I went to the window to see what it was because it sounded like a car crash. And I saw a car making an abrupt three-point turn, and that really just helped to solidify in my mind that that's what it was, that it had been a car crash. And I remember thinking that I have an additional car that is a SUV, an older SUV, that I usually live on the streets, and that day was going to be street cleaning day. And I remember before I went to bed that I pulled it in the parking, in my parking lot to make sure that it wasn't on the street. And that was my thought. Wow, I'm glad I moved the car because that car just hit someone. So I remember listening and looking intently to try to get a license plate number and get a good clear vision of what the SUV looked like because I'm thinking I'm going to be a good witness for one of my neighbors to tell them, someone just hit your car. And I don't remember what prompted me to go to the kitchen, but for some reason, I don't know, maybe I was just awake and wanted water. And I went to the kitchen and the faucet was on, the kitchen sink was on, and it was running full force. And I thought, wow, that's not normal. So I went to turn the water off and I saw that the blinds above the sink in the window, they were protruding a bit. And I raised the window to realize that my window had been broken. And there was something on the countertop. So I see this glass and everything. So I went and I tried to figure out what it was. And I remember that I picked up my, probably one of the few people that still have a landline. I still have a landline and I grabbed my phone and I thought, I'm gonna have to call the police because someone has thrown something through the window, which is what I thought at that time. So I had time to return to my bedroom and grab a robe and kind of prepare myself thinking this is gonna be a non-emergency call. It's probably gonna take them a while to respond. And as I went back to the kitchen, turned the light on and really looked around and I see this red liquid all over everything. And I couldn't for the life of me imagine what it was, but I was thinking it was a container that must have been contained with some red liquid in it. So I started to look for it. And I looked under the counter and under the table and I didn't see anything. And it was on the floor, but then it stopped. And so I was thinking it must be something that was in the kitchen. But then I happened to look into my dining room, and there was probably about a 5-foot gap between the space where it ended and then picked up again. And I noticed that this red trail was in the dining room. So I stepped into the dining room because I'm thinking, did it roll into here? Where is it? And as I stepped into the dining room, I looked into the living room. Now, mind you, it was 3 o'clock in the morning, so the living room was dark. And I see this image of a man standing in my living room, and all I could do was scream. All I could do was scream, and I remember as I was writing the book and I was trying to describe the scream, and I didn't have any words for it. All I could say was, it was a sound that came out of me that was even foreign to me. It wasn't something that I had ever heard before within myself. And even the sound of my scream scared me. And this person approached me, and he launched towards me, and he grabbed me. He grabbed me around my neck and around my shoulders. And I remember hearing sounds, not audible words. And I was grateful for having grown up in a house with brothers that were over 6 feet tall that I tussled with as a teenage girl and a young girl, that I immediately went into fight mode. I just started to defend myself, and I started to fight with everything that I had in me. And the oddest thing happened. It was where he started to sort of to put his arms up in a cross section of covering his face as if he was defending himself from me. And I heard the Holy Spirit. It was a voice just as clear in my head saying, stop. He's not fighting you anymore. And I paused just long enough to see if he was going to continue, and he did not. And I took that opportunity to back away from him. I backed away into my living room, and I'm shouting at him, get out, just get out. And he's standing there, and it occurs to me at that time that clearly he's on something. He's hallucinating, because he's staring around and he's looking at the ceiling, and his arms were bleeding. So he's looking at his arms and he's staring around and he's looking at me, but he's not seeing me. He's clearly confused about where he is. And I'm screaming at him to get out, and I realize I have the phone in my hand. So I start to try to dial 911. And I didn't want to look down long enough to actually look at the keyboard. And I remember I dialed the wrong number, and I could hear him say, the number you have dialed. And I just hung up, and I was frustrated. And I tried it again, and I got the 911 operator. And I'm screaming and saying, someone's in my home, someone's in my home. And I started to realize he was not going to leave, and that my best defense was to get out of the house myself. The way that he was standing in the living room blocked two of the entrances. It blocked me going to the front door, and it blocked me to be able to go to the kitchen where another exit door would have been. Mm-hmm. But behind me was my family room. And I had just had plantation shutters put in the den. And there was a guy, when he installed it, he was very careful to tell me that all the blinds need to be shut because it was a slider door as opposed to a French door. Mm. And he said, make sure that they're all lined up, or else when you open the door, it'll jam. So I took my hand and I rubbed it across the blinds to make sure that they were all closed flat. And once I realized that they were, I opened the door and I opened the sliding door to my patio, and I was able to exit my home. So I made the exit. I ran across the street. The side of my house that I had to come out of was the longest side of the house. So it felt like forever for me to try to get from the backyard around the side of the house out to the street. And I ran and I knocked on my neighbor's door. And I'm probably, knock is probably a gentle word. I was probably more like banged. And mm-hmm. I really just hit the door as hard as I could. Mm-hmm. And he finally came to the door, and I was just screaming, someone's in my house. In the meantime, the 911 operator is still on my phone, and she's telling me, calm down, calm down. And I'm barely paying attention to her.
Yeah.
I remember that it wasn't until that point that I looked to make sure he wasn't following me. Mm-hmm. I didn't never stop as I was running. I thought that might stop my momentum, so I kept running. Mm-hmm. So I was able to get out. I live in L.A. County, so the sheriff arrived. The first car arrived. It was a female deputy. I explained to her what was occurring. And several more cars arrived pretty quickly, and they were asking me information on how they could gain entry to my home. Mm-hmm. And I told them that the patio door would be open, since I had just exited through that way, that I knew the door would still be open. And my neighbor, he and his girlfriend at the time, they stopped, and they were saying, you don't have any shoes on. So my bare feet, clearly I wasn't thinking. So they gave me some shoes to put on. And they were trying to comfort me, and they said, he's out, he's out. And so I stepped outside, and I heard the little scuffle at the front door, and they were asking him, what are you doing here? And he was saying something, and I don't really remember what it was. But my next thing was, I remember going back across the street, and because I had had a lot of work done on my home, I had just had some painting done, I had the patio rebuilt, mm-hmm. so I'd had some work done, and I had heard horror stories about people that have construction companies, how sometimes there's one bad seed that perhaps could have returned, and I thought maybe this was someone that has been here. Mm-hmm. So I asked them to, they had him face down and they were handcuffing him, and I said, can you please turn him over? I want to see if I've ever seen him before.
Right.
And I realized that I had not. I had never seen him before. So they took him, put him on a gurney because he was bleeding profusely at this time. So they took him and put him on a gurney, put him in handcuffs, and they took him away.
Mm.
So you would think that would be the end of the story, but that was almost the beginning of a different kind of my nightmare beginning. Mm-hmm. The deputy then, she was taking pictures of all of the crime scene, and it took my neighbor to say, well, what about Vivica? She has blood on her. You haven't taken any pictures of her.
Mm-hmm.
And she more sort of haphazardly turned the camera and went click, click, okay, you're good, and walked away. I think it felt odd at the time, but I think I was still in shock to where I didn't take it personally at that time.
Mm-hmm.
In hindsight, I remembered that.
Yeah.
I remember that that was her attitude towards it. So I went back in the house, and there was just blood everywhere. I had an off-white sofa at the time, so not the best furniture to have when something like that occurs, because there was blood splattered. And so there was a splatter across all of the pillows.
Wow.
One of the corners where he obviously, I don't know if he stood at that spot for some time, but that was the part that was mostly covered. The floor was just, you know, I have hardwood floors, and it was just like I could see the scuffle, where the scuffle there, you know, the blood was not in any particular pattern, but you could tell how someone had stepped on it and moved it around. So I was frantic, and I just kept saying, look at all of this blood, look at all this blood.
Mm.
And my neighbor, so grateful for him. He used to call me baby girl, and he said, baby girl, don't look at it. Just turn around. I got it. And he said, give me something to wipe up. And I gave him something. I don't remember what it was. And I looked in the mirror at myself. And when I did, I saw all the blood on my shoulders and on my robe and on my feet. And I felt so violated. And I took everything off. I just took everything off, and everything in me wanted to get in the shower.
Mm.
But I kept thinking, there's so much blood in there that if I get in the shower, I'm still going to have to go back and work in an environment that I don't want to start cross-contaminating everything. So I changed clothes, and I threw those clothes. I think I just threw them in the washing machine or in the tub or something. I threw them somewhere. And I put on some more clothes, and I went back in there to help my neighbor. And at this point, he was getting up most of the glass, and I was very grateful that he had wiped up a large portion of the blood. And while I was in there, I heard what was clearly, now I knew, was to be the patrol car back outside again. And so I heard the radio in the car. And so I went to my front door, and she came in, and she told me that they had found the truck that he supposedly had been in, and she thought that was the truck because of the description that I had given, plus the information she was able to obtain from him after they had taken him into custody. And she said the hood was warm, and she found his shoe, and she found his cell phone. And so she told me that they didn't believe that he was going to hurt me.
What?
Yes, she said, oh, well, we don't think, and she said it so casually, oh, we don't think he was going to hurt you. It seems that he just got spooked. Those were his exact words.
He came into your house uninvited. It was a home invasion, and people are speculating whether or not he could have harmed you. He's not supposed to be in your home.
Right. So I remember asking the question. I said, well, this is a burglary, isn't it? And she says, well, no, because he didn't steal anything. And I said, but it's forced entry, so it should still be breaking and entering. And she said, yeah, well, he wasn't going to hurt you. And I said, but he grabbed me. That's assault. An unwanted touch is an assault. And I remember she looked at me and she said, yeah, but you're not hurt. And that's when everything changed for me in my mind. And I thought, what in the world is going on here now? So I stopped my neighbor from cleaning because I didn't trust her anymore. And so I grabbed my camera and I took some pictures myself. Even though a lot of it had been cleaned up, I wanted to get pictures to show that something had occurred because I did not trust her. So she left again. Maybe 10, 15 more minutes has gone by, and she returns another time. And when she returns, I hear the car outside again, and I just go to the door, and she says, ma'am, I have somebody here that wants to talk to you. Now, I see these people standing in the front yard, and I assume that they are detectives. It's 3 o'clock in the morning. Well, now almost 4 o'clock in the morning. I'm thinking they probably got called in the middle of the night. They were at home, and, you know, it's 4 o'clock in the morning. They're in plain clothes. And she says, these are his parents.
Ludicrous.
His parents want to talk to you. And I said, what? So they're standing in my front yard staring at me while she's asking me if I will give them permission to speak with me. I wanted to say no, but at the same time, I felt so violated that I also thought, who are they? Who are they? And now they know where I live. They know who I am. They know what I look like. I need to know something about who they are. So I said yes. And I did it primarily so that I could get their information. I wanted to know their names and all of the information that I could obtain for them. And they immediately just started to plead for me not to press charges against their son. And I thought afterwards, they never once asked me if I was hurt. They never asked me anything. And instead, they just started to really plead with me not to press charges against their son. They started telling me, you know, he doesn't have a record and, you know, just don't press charges and we'll pay for the damage. And I said, you know, right now, your son's blood is all over my front of my house. And I'm really not concerned with any of that right now. And the mother, when I remember that the mother and father were standing there and I asked, does your son have, has he ever been in trouble before? And they said, well, no. I said, he's not ever been arrested? And they said, no. And I said, does he have a drug problem? And they both got silent. And the father kind of looked away. And the mother, she stopped. And then she said, no, I don't think so. And it was, I've been around enough parents to know, I don't have children, but I have nieces and nephews. And I know the protection mode of quickly asking yourself, have I ever seen him do it? You know, seeing him afterwards, I know something, but I can answer this honestly and say that I don't know. So I realized she was trying to protect her son. And I took their information and they left. So I, by that time, my cousin had arrived. I had called her. And so we sat there and we tried to kind of unpack what had just happened. And I told her everything that I was feeling. And then I called a window repair, an emergency window repair company to come and to repair the window for the night temporarily. And I dialed the number because I was like, I wonder if they are who they said they are. And, I, you know, I want to pull out something and look on the internet and Google their names and see if I can find out anything about who these people
are.
That
curiosity is normal.
Yes. I didn't find anything. I didn't find anything. So instead, the parents, they answered the phone. And this was at least another hour after, between the time that they had been at my home and the time that I called. And I said, so where's your son? And they told me, well, we're not sure. He may be at Lakewood or he might be at Long Beach Memorial. And so I thought, now you got a call that allowed you to arrive to my house within practically 30 minutes of the incident. But now, a couple of hours later, you still don't even know where your son is. So I thought that was very strange, very odd. And it just kept getting more and more crazy after that. I stayed up that night, of course, and was waiting for the police report. And I had been working with a lot of people in law enforcement and the insurance business that I was in for a number of years. So I knew just about, as a matter of fact, I've worked every sheriff's station in L.A. County. So I thought, oh, when daybreak happens, I'll call someone I know and see if I can't get some information. And I was instructed to reach out and ask for the report number and then get the names of the detectives that would have been assigned the case. And so that's what I did. So I called, only to find out that after being put on hold by the LET, which is the law enforcement technician, the LET, when she answered the phone, she kept putting me on hold and she kept asking me these questions. Well, what street did you say you live on? What day did you say this occurred? Mm-hmm. Was this an incident with a neighbor perhaps? And she kept putting me on hold. And I said, wait. Are you trying to tell me that you don't even have a report on this? And she said, no, ma'am, there's no report.
Oh, may I ask some questions for clarification?
Sure.
Ms. Vivica? All right. For the listeners, too, I have to ask for physical description of the intruder because this story sounds uncomfortably familiar to some of the stories that my female friends have described. And from my own observation and from the stories my friends have told me, there is unequal application of the law.
Yes.
Based on gender and based on color.
Yes.
Would it be okay, Ms. Vivica, for you to describe the person who attacked you in your home?
Yes. He was probably about 6 feet tall, very thin, and he was white. And I'm an African-American woman. So he was, I would guess at the time, 30-ish. He appeared young, but just tall and thin, had sandy brown hair, plaid shirt, jeans. So nothing other than that.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
But the interesting thing after that was the care that the sheriff was offering him in their conversation with me. They even once told me when I asked for something and I complained about the report not having been filed, and they said, well, we spoke with him. We had to make sure he was okay. And I remember I was so livid, and I was screaming, and I'm saying, what? You're concerned about him? The only reason he's hurt is because he jumped through a double pane window into my home.
Yes.
And they kept, and this phrase occurred that would haunt me, which was, well, he placed his hands on your shoulders. And I remember thinking it was not a waltz. This was not a dance. This was not something that was a welcome, invited person. This was an intruder. And it even got so crazy that beyond the detective, the way that they file the report is how it will be, the DA will determine which charges to file. So this person was never charged with assault and battery. He was charged with misdemeanor vandalism, which is less than $2,000 or less than $400, I think, in damage is considered a misdemeanor. I had over $20,000 in damage in my home because I found out that blood being a hazardous material, when the insurance company got involved, they relocated me to a hotel for 2 weeks when the hazardous material unit had to come in and destroy, not just clean, but destroy anything that was a porous environment that had come in contact with the blood.
Such an upheaval of your life, and there was law enforcement asking if the young man was okay.
The DA, when I spoke to him later, he said that before filing charges, he had a conversation with him. And I thought, so there were two people in that room. One who was clearly hallucinating on some type of drug, who was a criminal, and me, a woman who was the homeowner. And you had to, and you only ask his opinion of what happened? First he said, well, you know, you can't always talk to everyone in a case. And I said, but there was only two people. And you chose to get the criminal's opinion of what happened that night, and you never asked me what happened. And he said to me that, he has no recollection of that night. And even with that, they never asked me for clarification. This young man got away with a misdemeanor.
That is just, that's evidence of wrongdoing by the person who did the home invasion and wrongdoing by law enforcement. And for me, as I'm listening to this story, I read your book, and thank you for saying it live here. My hair is on fire with this anger, but from scripture, I'm reminded that it's be angry and do not sin.
Right.
So take a breath here.
Right.
For what you've chosen to do with the story that has happened to you, you have done something that's incredible, and I'm going to kind of just ask you to talk about it a bit more. From this really painful incident, you've turned this into a sort of a ministry, inviting others to tell their story. And you have a few follow-up questions, and one of the follow-up questions that really resonates with me is, how were you disappointed by others during your trauma? And what can people do in the future for other people? So would you be willing to talk about how you've collected other stories?
Yes, yes. For me, and I use a line in the book that says, the confusion that I felt was somewhere between puberty, PMS, menopause, midlife crisis, and dementia, all at the same time. And I experienced something that was so foreign to me because I had been that person that other people look to when they need assistance. And it was very difficult for me to try to figure out how to handle it. And I questioned, where was God? Where was God? Why did this happen? I'm the only single person on my block. Any other house on the block would have had a male in there that would have been able to defend their family. And then I felt guilty about that and said, I don't wish this on anyone. But there was still a why. You know, why did this happen? What am I supposed to get out of this other than fear? I just know that God is not the author of fear. There's no way that that was all he wanted me to live with. And then my next experience was how people responded to me. They didn't know what to say to me. It made them uncomfortable. I only told a few people initially just because I didn't even tell my own family, or not everyone. I kept it in a very small circle. For one thing, they wanted me to continue to repeat it and relive it, and mm-hmm. that was just too hard initially.
Mm-hmm.
And I needed somewhere where I felt normal, where people didn't look at me like a victim. So after I had a few months, in hindsight, I really just sought after God, and I was so grateful, not for what happened, but I was grateful for what didn't happen. And I realized he was there all the time. He didn't allow me to get beat. He didn't allow me to get raped. He didn't allow me to be murdered. So he was there. And he still, even in the midst of it, I knew that he was going to see me through it. But my experience with the trauma was such that I needed someone to hear me. People kept dismissing how I felt because of who I was, because I'm a minister. They came to me for assistance. I had been a counselor, so they came to me for answers and to talk their way through their problems, and they didn't know what to say to me. So then I began to wonder, is this normal? Is this what people go through when they've had a trauma in their lives? So as I began to share my story, people started to tell me their stories. And so I decided to write a book, which I'm now creating as a series, and it's Valor to Victory. So Valor and the number 2 and Victory. 2 is because it's you and God through it all. It's always him there, so I have the number 2 and not the word 2. It takes 2 people to get through this, you and him. And I wanted to know, was this a normal practice? Is this how people respond? So I asked people to tell me their story. Tell me how you felt. And then at the end of their story, I asked 3 specific questions, as you said. The first one is, what did someone or people do that helped you? What did someone or people do that disappointed you? And what could someone or people have done that would have made a difference? What would have helped you? Because that's what we don't know how to do.
Mm-hmm.
We don't know what to say. We don't know what to do. And so I wanted to write this series to encourage someone who's going through it to know that you will make it through it. But I also wanted the people who were trying to support that person to have some idea as to what they should and should not do.
Mm-hmm.
I think for all of the stories, there's 6 stories in my book. It tells you that there's 7. My books say what there are 7. And because 7 is the number of completion, so the last chapter is blank because I think no story is complete unless yours is included.
Mm-hmm.
So those last pages are for you to journal about your story or someone else's story. After you've read these stories, there will be something that may come to mind. So I leave you an opportunity to write your own story.
Thank you that the story doesn't just end with 3 a.m., but that you're inviting other stories of valor to victory. And what really resonates with me is that this is also a beautiful way to have an instruction manual.
Yes.
It's true story plus instruction manual for people who do care and say, well, in my case, I say, like, leadership needs hugs too.
It's really a
real thing. They hurt. They bleed.
Yes.
They cry.
I think the 3 most powerful words that I wrote in that book was just show up. Just show up. If a person has been traumatized, they are not going to ask you to do anything for them. They're just trying to make it through the next second. But they may have dishes in the sink. They're not going to ask you to drive, especially here in California where your friends may live 20, 30 minutes away from you. You're not going to ask someone to drive across town to come and just put the dishes in the dishwasher for me or just wash them for me and put them up. And you really don't even care at that moment. You're just trying to get through. But if they were there, they would see the dishes in the sink, and they could just take the initiative to do it and to wash the dishes themselves. One of the lines that I wrote in the book, I actually highlighted that I wanted to be able to share. And it says, the only way to describe this is if you are an African-American watching a movie about slavery and the slave describes some injustice to the slave master and is told to quit complaining because you cannot tell anything on a white man. Whatever he did was considered legal because you have no rights. And that's what I felt like at that moment. And I never wanted anyone else to feel like that. And valor to victory lets them stop being silent and gives them an opportunity to have a voice and say, this did happen to me and it was wrong. And someone else needs to know that it happened. Because when it happens to you, you feel very isolated. So I encourage anyone who has gone through it, even to seek therapy. And even in that, be selective. I actually sought out a therapist and I had 3 therapists, just went to one visit each. And each time I was like, no, that's not the person. There was just something. And ironically, the last person that I selected, I ended up working with her through it because I needed someone to stop telling me I was going to be okay. I was going to be okay, but that was way down the road in the future. Mm-hmm. Right then, I was not okay. And I needed to be heard and validated that it's okay to be angry and it's okay to be afraid right now. God is going to see you through that fear. Mm-hmm. But yes, what you feel right now is fear.
Yeah.
And people were giving me scriptures. You know, God has not given us a spirit of fear. Yes, but I was afraid.
Yes.
I was in my house alone, 3 o'clock in the morning, and I spent many nights after that, you know, with all the lights on. Mm-hmm. So it wasn't the time to quote the scripture. It was the time to allow me to say I was afraid and say, I'm sorry you feel that way.
Thank you for saying that. Since you've done physical descriptions, I'll also do a physical description for the listeners of myself. I'm a Chinese American gal here. And I've always been described as the leadership type. And oftentimes people say, you're a strong lady. You know, you can just shake this off and keep on going. It's like, but I hurt right now. It's like, but aren't you a Christian? It's like, yes, I trust in the Lord, but I am bleeding. I am bleeding and my heart is hurting so bad.
Yes.
Badly. So what you say here gives us permission, and also it's aligned with scripture that God cares about us and our details. He knows when we cry. He knows when we hurt. He's there to bandage our wounds. You know, yes, there is eternity and there's the Holy Spirit and the comfort and the counselor, all of that. But it's okay to scream and say, like, I'm hurting and I'm scared right now.
Right, right. I think it would almost be unnatural for you as a woman to have been assaulted and not be experience some type of fear. Mm-hmm. And to where for anyone to minimize that and to try to negate what you feel by trying to attach it to a scripture is so not what God had in mind. He's such a loving God that there is no way that he wouldn't first comfort you, as opposed to dismissing what you feel and then just saying you're going to be okay. Mm-hmm. It would be in such kindness and such gentleness that he would be able to share those words with you. So I think having the validation, having someone hear you and saying, I understand. Don't say, I get it, and you know, that's exactly how I feel. And I, because two things, if it has never happened to you, you do not have any idea what that feels like. And even if something similar has happened to you, doesn't mean you really know how I feel. So what your experience was may be totally different than mine. So as a friend, being a good listener and just hearing what that person says, you don't have to have the resolution. You don't have to have the answer. You don't have to have any of the guidelines to walk them through it. And sometimes they're not looking for that. They just want to be heard. They just need to just be frustrated, be mad one minute, cry the next minute, and be excited and confused the next. There's so many different emotions, and to just have someone to listen. And ironically, the point I was going to make about the therapist, the last session, I was in the process of changing churches. The last session that I was there, I said, oh, by the way, I found a new church home. And I told her it was SBC with Pastor Ivan Pitts.
Mm-hmm.
And she looked at me and smiled. And she said, that's my church home. So, yes, I ended up at the church home with my therapist. And to this day, we have shared ministry and worked together. And it's so refreshing to just understand that God took me on a path and then led me to a place that I would end up in a place where I could be healed and made whole again in his presence.
And with that, I will have my last question for you. What does the future hold for you since tonight is New Year's Eve?
Wow, huh? 2019 is coming to an end already. What I want to be able to do and what I'm trusting God to allow me to do is use Valor to Victory to tell other people's stories. I'm working on one right now that is on women who have survived homelessness. So their Valor to Victory is a little different. I also have interviewed a few people for cancer survivors. And so I'm looking at opportunities to be able to not just hear their stories, but those three questions. What could we do? What did we do right? What did we do wrong? And what could we have done? Sometimes we really have a heart's desire to help, and we just don't know what to do. So that's my journey, is I want to be able to give us suggestions on what we can do to help one another.
And with that, I want to say thank you, Sister Vivica, for talking with me today.
Thank you. Again, the name of the book is Valor to Victory, and the subtitle on this one is Removing the Drama from Your Trauma. My contact information is Miss Vivica. Actually, the website is just missvivica.com, so that's MSVIVICA.com. MSVIVICA.com. God bless you.
We are good. Thank you, Vivica.
Thank you.
This.
Thank you.
I got really hot and pretty angry again, even though it's not the first time I heard the story.
I know. I kind of went through it a little bit this morning.
Okay. Are you doing okay?
Mm-hmm.
It's not easy to tell it again.
I think that in hindsight now, it's empowering.